The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This week in Retronauts, we're still processing Blast. Everyone, it's Jeremy Parrish again for Retronauts, and we're talking about Mega Drive, Sega Genesis again. You've already heard the episode where a bunch of people who didn't own a Genesis got together and said, this was a good and important system with some okay games that we like. But I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had an expert opinion? And so, as an expert opinion, someone who knows a lot about Genesis, who goes under the alias Sega 16 on the internet, you don't get much more Sega Genesis than that. We have
Ken Horowitz.
All right, Ken, thank you for taking time out of your long trip to Portland to come and talk about the Sega Genesis.
Oh, thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So tell me a little bit about your history with the system. I mean, everyone knows the Retronauts shame that we didn't own Sega systems as kids. Got into Sega much later. But I'm assuming that you're someone who has been much more enthusiastic about Sega throughout his life.
Well, yeah, actually, I've been a Sega fan since the arcade days, and you could always tell a Sega arcade game from the rest of the games in the arcade
because they kicked ass.
Yeah, they always seemed to be. I don't know. Maybe it could be bias. It could be just, you know, rose-colored glasses, whatever. But it always seemed to me like they were, especially from 1984 on, there always seemed to be like just like a step ahead of everybody else. And but the thing was is that I actually was going to buy an NES. I had when it came out. I pestered my father for my birthday in August. He didn't get me one, so I said, "You're going to get me one for Christmas." And I pestered and pestered and pestered. And he took me. This is the Christmas that the NES was launched nationally. He took me on
so
Christmas. 86. Yeah, he took me Christmas Eve to look for an NES.
I bet you didn't find one.
We went to nine stores.
I bet they were
stores,
totally sold out.
Gone. There were people offering double the retail price for the display model.
Wow.
And so he was like, "Oh, I guess we don't get one." But, you know, I guess he felt bad because he had really, you know, messed up. So he's like, "Okay, you can get an Atari 2600 Junior with 10 games, or you can get a Sega Master System, which they still had, and one game." And so I was like, 10 games, Atari. I liked Atari a lot. But then I looked at the Master System, I looked at the graphics, and I was going back and forth. My brother leaned over, my older brother, and he said, "If you get the Master System, I'll buy F-16 Fighting Falcon." So I was like, "Oh, sweet, another game." So I got the Master System. And that just,
And you know, what was the game that you picked with the Master System?
The Ninja.
Okay.
Still one of my favorite games to this day. And so I enjoyed my Master System greatly. And then when the Genesis came out, I once again asked for Christmas, for that Christmas. But by then I was in high school. So my dad had more of a, you know, "You're 16, why don't you work and pay for it yourself" attitude. But when, you know, I guess he kind of got reminded of how he messed up with the NES before. So when I went to visit him that summer, he took me to 7 more stores because he could not believe that they all cost $189.99. He believed it was price fixing. I was like, "Dad, that's the retail price." And so he took me to all these stores and I got a Sega Genesis console with Altered Beast. I had already bought World Championship Soccer because all my friends and I made, they all bought the console. And so we all made a pact, like everyone would buy a different game and then we would just lend them to each other. And that way nobody would have the same game twice and we could play them all.
That's an amazing pact. That's really awesome.
And so, but the thing was, is that since I didn't have a console, by the time I actually got around to buying a game, the only game that was left was World Championship Soccer. So I was like, screw it, I'm buying this game. And I took it with me to Texas to see my dad, and without the console. He bought the console. A friend of mine had given me money to buy Super Hang-On for him. And I did that under the condition that I could open it and play it. And he said, okay. So I had Altered Beast. I had World Championship Soccer and Super Hang-On. And my dad went to work, and I stayed home all day, played through the entire World Tournament and World Championship Soccer, played through Super Hang-On, played through Altered Beast multiple times, and it was just amazing.
So this was this 89 when the...
No, this was August 90.
Okay. So the Genesis had been around for about a year and had developed a pretty decent library by that point, but it wasn't quite to Sonic the Hedgehog yet.
No, 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 no. But since they had like Golden Axe and they had Alex Kidd, which I had really liked on the Master System, and they had Revenge of Shinobi, and I was a fan of the arcade and Master System Shinobi. So, and then Phantasy Star 2, you know, those games were either there or about to be released. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot in the library as a Sega arcade and Master System fan that I was really looking forward to.
Mm-hmm. So can you sell me on Alex Kidd for Sega Genesis? Because I've tried playing that game, and I'm just like, every time I bounce off of it, is there something to it that I'm missing?
It tries to go back to Alex Kidd and Miracle World, which was probably the best one. They kind of went in different directions with the other. Oh, well, it might not be the best one, but I think it's the best one, my favorite. And they kind of went in different directions with the other ones, High Tech World, Shinobi World. But they tried to come back to the original formula with Enchanted Castle. And the thing about Alex Kidd is that they tried to be Super Mario, and it doesn't work as a Super Mario clone. But if they had just decided to take that dynamic and do something a little bit different, it could have stood alone as its own game. Because when I play it, I don't get a Mario feel. I mean,
it doesn't feel like Mario.
No. So when I read that you know, they were trying to emulate Mario, it's just I don't feel it.
Well, I think, you know, on Master System, the very first one, Miracle World, I think that is very Mario-like. But yeah, by the time you get to the Genesis game, it's kind of like.
But the thing is, even in the Master System one, I mean, you have like the motorcycle and the pedicopter and all these things, and then the bosses are, you know, rock, scissor, paper battles.
Right, right.
So it didn't have that. It had like that platform feel that Mario had, but it just didn't. I didn't feel like, oh, they're just trying to do Mario. It seemed like to have a little bit of its own identity. Mm-hmm. They tried to come back to that with the Enchanted Castle, but the thing was is that. The biggest problem with that I found with Miracle World is that the jumping was a little bit too floaty, and so like the jump kick, like you jump and when he comes down, he has like a drop kick, and you have to really, really time that right, and it's like the reach distance with his punch could be better. So if they had tweaked that a bit, the gameplay would have been a lot. And also he slides around a lot. So if they had like tweaked the gameplay a little bit more, it would have fixed the biggest flaw with the Master System version, I think. But they kind of left it that way, and so it improves graphically and sound and everything, but because of the way the gameplay is set up, the game can be unnecessarily hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so it comes off as cheap in many places.
Okay. So you haven't quite sold me on it, but
well, it's one of those, I think it's an acquired taste.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not a pickup and, oh man, I have to have this game. I mean, it's like either like Alex Kidd or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And the gameplay doesn't really help sell
mm-hmm.
the game. But if once you can, once you understand it and you can accept, okay, this is the way it plays and I just have to deal with it, right? The game actually is enjoyable. But if I were to recommend Genesis platformers to you, I would probably recommend a couple of dozen ahead of it.
Right. So what would you recommend in terms of Genesis platformers?
Well, Genesis platformers, absolutely. I like Sonic, but I'm not as big a Sonic fan as a lot of people, other people are. I would have to put the top two platformers on my list. Well, top three would be Ristar,
mm-hmm.
Rocket Knight Adventures,
mm-hmm.
and Pulse Man.
Okay. And Ristar is by Sega, but the other two are third-party titles.
Yeah.
So that really speaks to, I think, what Genesis did better than Master System by far, which is bring in third-party developers and really enrich the diversity of the library.
Well, Ed, there were a lot of factors involved in that that kind of played into Sega's hands. I think Nintendo kind of got into a position where it couldn't keep third-party companies from dealing – you know, it couldn't – tell them to ignore the competition because the competition was growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to kind of just say, okay, you know, ease the restrictions they had in licensing and let the other companies make games for the consoles. And once they did that, that's when you had Konami and Capcom and all these other Taito, Data East, and all these other companies come on board. And that's when the Genesis, I think, really took off. Mm. I mean, Sonic kind of got that ball rolling. A lot of people think that Sonic is what set the Genesis off in success. It got the ball rolling, but it wasn't the thing that made it the success it was, because Sonic would have been an immensely successful game, and then you would have just gone right back to what you had before Sonic, because there was nothing to continue that momentum. It was the fact that showed third-party companies that the console was actually – viable and you know, hey, we should be making games for that. And so once they came aboard, that just snowballed and allowed the console to become as successful as it was.
You can go again. Don't fall behind. Say, don't be late. This nation, heaven. Stay alive. Now, you and me. We're going to have fun. Say, nice off. What do you mean? Give it four holes.
So what do you think were the strengths of the Sega Genesis, you know, besides what we just talked about? Like, as a piece of hardware, why do you think it succeeded so effectively where the Master System hadn't?
I think because it was much easier to develop for. I also think that the processor, at the time it came out, was extremely fast. Mm-hmm. And so it allowed
it was a blazing 7 megahertz.
Don't
sneeze at that kind of speed.
I mean, but for games like for platformers, action titles, running guns, shooters, I mean, it's tailor-made for that. So I think that was very, very attractive. And it was the kind of console that if it didn't have tools, the developers could make their own tools, and it was a lot easier. It was actually a lot easier. For example, I've spoken to people who worked on the Super NES, and is that correct? Is it Super NES or is it
Super
NES?
Super NES on the show, yes.
Yeah.
Well, we're not British, so we don't say SNES. Yeah.
Since I was living in Puerto Rico when the console was released, so there was the Nintendo and then the Super Nintendo, and that's what they called it.
I mean, that's really what everyone I knew called it. It was Super Nintendo games, yeah.
So I've spoken to developers who develop for both consoles, and many of them tell me that it was a lot easier for them to develop their own tools for the Genesis. And that's why, like for sports games and things, a lot of times the Genesis was the lead console, because Sega of Japan wasn't very forthcoming with the tools.
Mm-hmm.
And that's – they kind of – and some developers told me that they would either give you the tools with all the documentation in Japanese – or they would give you the tools and leave out certain features.
Okay. I literally just had this conversation last night with Rebecca Heineman about programming for Super NES, where they gave her the documentation in Japanese, and she had to, like, learn katakana to figure out, like, what is it actually saying? And, at the same time, she loves programming for Super NES. She said it was – like, it was basically the same as an Apple 2GS.
Uh-huh.
So it was, like, a lot of fun for her to program for because she had a lot of experience with the other system. But, you know, I think the Genesis was more like a lot of the other systems that were currently on the market, like arcades. You know, they used the Motorola 68000 family. So,
yeah.
So it was a really comfortable, well-documented platform.
Yeah, and and that's why, for example, that's why the GEMS, the sound driver, that's why that came about, because a lot of developers were locked out. And so Sega of America actually contracted Bert Sloan, John Miller, and a couple other people to create audio tools, because they need – and the thing is the GEMS sound driver in many aspects emulates sounds that the Genesis can produce natively, because since they don't have they didn't have access to that. So they, instead of being able to access natively, they had to go and find a way to basically emulate sounds.
Interesting.
So and that's why if you look at the list of GEM software, the titles that use the GEM software, a lot of them, virtually all of them, are Western, American, mm-hmm. and European, because they had to do that because they either got the documentation. I've had developers tell me that they actually got documentation from Japan on a napkin in Japanese.
What?
You know, so it's like here.
Napkin notes are supposed to be like where you have the first idea and you're like, oh, let's go build this. Not something down the line.
You write that on a napkin when you say, I'm going to write this down so I don't forget it as I get to my hotel room to put it on paper.
Right.
And so it was – the attitude in many cases was, well, see what you can do with this, you know. And a lot of them had to actually create tools or make do with what they had. So that's why you hear a lot of people say that, oh, how come the Japanese games sound better than the American games? And a lot of it has to do with that. And you see, you listen to games like Phantasy Star 2. This is always the example that comes to mind to me. That game has sound effects and music effects that I have not heard in virtually any other game. It's like they just milked the sound chip and just brought out every sound they could get out of it, they incorporated into the game. And you don't hear those sounds in Western games. But a lot of it had to do with that. But even still, with that limitation, a lot of people were able to make the Genesis do things that people thought that chip, especially by 92, 93, that processor was already starting to get long in the tooth. They were able to keep it doing things that nobody thought it could do.
Yeah, I mean, Gunstar Heroes, you think of that as being like the pinnacle of Sega Genesis, and that didn't come around until 94.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Saturn was already pretty much well on its way at that point. So there was a lot of great stuff happening late in the system's life. But the America versus Japan thing, whether deliberate or just as a sort of incidental factor that arose out of the nature of the business, that seems to be kind of the story of the Sega Genesis. Like it really feels like there were two kingdoms involved, and the things that they did in America were all kind of scrappy, like, we're figuring this out, we're breaking the rules, we're doing things a different way, and that really helped the system in a way that it might not have happened if the whole thing had just been controlled top-down from Japan the way Nintendo did with Super NES.
Well, I like when we get into this discussion, and this discussion seems to never stop, you know, about the whole Japan versus U.S., and people say, well, Sega of America with the – you know, but the thing is, there are a lot of contradicting arguments, because people say that, like, when Sega contracted Tonka to distribute the Master System, that the reason it failed is because they hired a toy company that knew nothing of video games. And then they go on and they praise the work of Tom Kalinske, who was a former toy executive who knew nothing about video games when he joined Sega. You know, and
well, there's a difference between someone, like one person kind of managing a business versus another company figuring out distribution and marketing for something. I mean, they're different disciplines.
Well, but he had to deal with distribution and marketing, but he also had to deal with game, you know, localizing game software and getting stores into retail, games into retail and things like that, where Tonka only had to deal with distribution and marketing. They didn't have to really deal. They chose some games that came over, but they didn't really have to deal with any of the development side at all. And so they didn't have to worry about creating software and targeting software for a specific audience. All they had to do was just market and release. But the thing was is that, like, you have that argument, and then when people talk about how Sega of America failed with the 32X and the Saturn, and that was all because Sega of America was doing whatever it wanted, it should have just listened to Japan and done what Japan told it to do. But that's exactly what it did with the Master System, and it got 2% market share. You know, it wasn't until that Sega was able to do what needed to be done to be done for the specific region of North America, you know, that it was able to actually be successful. People complain that they released too many sports games. But at one point, sports games counted for 42% of Sega of America's revenue.
And they're about 90% of what you find at flea markets now for Sega Genesis.
Yeah, that's the reason why I will never have a complete Sega Genesis set, because I simply just couldn't stand to look at 10 versions of Madden and NHL hockey and soccer and all that on my shelf. I'm not going to play those games, and I would rather save that shelf space for new releases that are coming out, like Xenocrisis and Kung Fu UFO, if Kickstarter works. I'd rather save the shelf space for that than just be able to say, I have every Madden ever released, you know? So.
John Madden sad. How's he going to afford his turduckens?
Yeah, well, well, I have like I'll keep like the first Madden because of the story behind that, and I'll keep like Lakers versus Celtics because that game was like the first 16-bit sports title I played and I loved it, and I'll keep like USA Basketball because, you know, the Dream Team, that was cool, and Joe Montana Football because of the story behind that. But that's like the only sports games that I'll on NHL 94, which. I really, really love. So I still have that one. And World Series Baseball.
So actually quite a few.
Quite a few.
But yeah, you know, you mentioned the story behind the first Madden. And that's actually kind of what I was referring to when I said that, you know, the U.S. developers and publishers had to kind of be plucky and sort of work against the rules. I wasn't necessarily speaking so much Sega internally, which, you know, to a certain degree, yes. But there was definitely they were still part of a corporate unit. I mean, STI existed and – that wouldn't have existed if Sega of Japan was like, America, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, clearly, the American business was extremely valuable to Sega and the American arm. But then you had, you know, third-party developers or what do you consider EA doing its own thing? Is that like fourth party? Like, they're not even necessarily allowed to be on the system, but they force their way on anyway. Like, that's, you know, that's kind of what I was talking about is I think – because the Genesis hardware was not off-the-shelf components, but well-documented components, you know, a very popular and powerful processor, it opened the door for people to come in a way that they couldn't necessarily do with the NES or Master System and, you know, sort of figure things out. But it's worth talking about the story behind the original Madden because we didn't address that on our kind of software-focused episode. But that was a huge part of why the Genesis became big in America, because EA basically like shoved their way in the door and were like, hey guys, we're publishing on Genesis, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. They did Madden, other games like Zany Golf, Sword of Sodan. Although I think if Sega had looked at Sword of Sodan and said, if that's what you're going to release, then no thanks. But that wouldn't have been a good argument for EA. But yeah, and then it got to the point you look at that EA was a company that basically kind of strong-armed its way into development on the Genesis. Going from that to not only becoming like the biggest third-party publisher, but also responsible for Joe Montana Football, which was basically the game that not only – I mean, people talk about the rivalry between NFL and Madden, but Joe Montana Football was basically the game – that started the, you know, got the ball rolling with Sega Sports, which became huge in all different types of sports. So, and EA was basically responsible for that. I mean, the people who made the Genesis version of Madden are the ones who made the Genesis version of Joe Montana Football, Park Place Productions. And their final product was actually superior to Madden. And Trip Hawkins told them, you know, you're not going to release a game that's going to kick our own game's ass. So they had to go and take out elements and make it more arcade-y.
They actually made their game worse?
Yeah. No, yeah. They actually had to remove features so that it wouldn't overshadow Madden. And even though that game was – the game was supposed to come out in October and it came out in January of 91, it actually sold quite well. And it showed that that game was vital because it showed Sega of America was trying to show Sega of Japan the need for internal development in America, and games like sports were important because Americans want to play football, they want to play baseball, basketball, and that game, even though it released so late, I mean practically when the Super Bowl was on, that it was successful, was key in convincing Sega of Japan to allow Sega of America to start its own studios and begin its own development. STI had the benefit of Mark Cerny's relationship with Hayao Nakayama because Mark Cerny had worked on Master System games. He had worked on Sega arcade games. So he already had a pretty good relationship with Sega of Japan to be able to get that ball rolling. But the whole purpose of STI was to train American developers to make games for the system.
Yeah, I think we're kind of making the assumption here that people listening necessarily know what STI is and how EA got onto the platform in the first place. That might be good to clarify. Like, as someone who's done a lot of research into this, what can you tell me about STI, Sega, or Sonic? Is it Sega Technical?
Sega Technical okay. Institute. Yes. Yeah, Sega Technical Institute was a studio started in 1990 by Mark Cerny, one of the architects behind the PlayStation 4, creator of Marble Madness. Mm-hmm. And he and a couple of other Japanese developers, including Yutaka Sugano, who made Shinobi, and a couple of others, veterans, were sent over to the United States to help recruit and train American programmers, designers, to create games for America. And the very first game they did was Dick Tracy.
The movie tie-in to the Warren Beatty movie?
Yeah, and they tried to do – I was reading recently – Mark Cerny talking about that, where they had since the game was so, you know, it was a licensed title, had to tie in with the movie, had to be released by a certain date. So there were a lot of things that they wanted to do that they basically couldn't do because they had to get the game out. And then they did Kid Chameleon, and they did other games like The Ooze. They did Comic Zone. Mm-hmm. They did Sonic 2.
We talked about Comic Zone a lot on our other episode, and it was a very unfair game, but such a fascinating concept.
Yeah, the fact that they were actually trying, they were ready and willing to do a sequel, and they didn't get the green light. That's a franchise that I really would have liked to see brought back, but it would be like 2.5D if they did it now. They can't. That's not a game that it's a comic book, can't be 3D.
I agree.
So. But it's a shame that that game never got another chance. Kid Chameleon, you know, which was a really good game that they wanted to do a sequel, were planning to do a sequel, and it got canceled as well. And there are a couple other games, Jester, Spinny and Spike, that were in the planning stages or in development and got canceled. But that was the whole purpose of STI, to spearhead that North American development movement. And from there, you got the Sega Multimedia Studio followed, Sega Studios LA, which did Full Motion, Sega Midwest. And by then, they had a full catalog of internal studios.
So how come so many of those games got canceled? They seemed promising.
Because that Sonic had a lot to do with it.
Ah.
Because a lot of the – there were multiple factors. The fact that Sonic was priority. The fact that there are a lot of back and forth in stories about whether or not the Japanese and American sides of those teams actually worked well together. People always like to hinge on their argument on the fact that the Americans were in one office and across the hall with the Japanese teams. But no one that I've ever spoken to on the American side, no one I've ever spoken to or read about, talked about it on the Japanese side, has ever said anything other than the only heated moments would have been perhaps because of the language barrier and the frustrations of not being able to communicate ideas, but that there was no rivalry, there was no internal strife or animosity among the teams. You know, Japanese have a very different way of doing things than American.
Yeah, the corporate culture there and the workflow is very different. It is, like I said, top down.
Yeah.
Whereas American workflow tends to be a lot more democratic. There's a lot more, less like one person who calls the shots and there's a lot more opportunity for other people to give feedback and a democratic process to take place.
Yeah, so there, you had that clash of cultures to some degree, but there was no rivalry between the members. They got along well enough. And so I think that there was also the fact that some of the members went back to Japan, like Yuji Naka had come to America because he was unsatisfied with the compensation for Sonic, and he came to America to work on Sega Technical Institute, did Sonic 2, and then with some success, he went back to Japan. A couple of members went back to Japan as well. So Japan had certain priorities. America had other priorities. Sonic was a company-wide priority. And so there were a lot of factors involved there that there were certain projects that just had to be prioritized over others. And so also the fact that, for example, I think it was Spinny and Spike was Steve Wojta's game. If I get it wrong, Steve's going to kill me. But I'm pretty sure it was that game that he and Adrian – I forget his last name. he and another programmer, I know his first name's Adrian, but his last name escapes me. They had left to work on another project, and they were going to work on Spinny and Spike. They left to work on another project. When they came back, development had already been like assigned to somebody else. That kind of annoyed them. So you did have that, like, but locally within Sega of America, the corporate thing that elements that kind of works has traditionally worked against. I mean, programmers who read about how Atari programmers were compensated, and then now this week we're reading about Red Dead Redemption and Rockstar, mm-hmm. and so it's, you know, that's a never-ending problem in game development,
right?
And EA.
Right. Yeah, going back to the EA thing, the shenanigans they achieved.
Yeah, they basically reverse engineered the Genesis, and were going to make games regardless of whether or not Sega gave them a license, and Sega kind of acquiesced in many regards to their demands and gave in, and it turned out to be mutually beneficial in the long run. But I think probably. Michael Katz, who was president of Sega of America at the time that EA was doing its reverse engineering, probably had his reservations about it because, you know, this is a company.
No one wants to negotiate with terrorists.
Exactly. But also a terrorist that, you know, you're going and you're signing all these big sports licensees. You know, you're getting Pat Riley and Tommy Lasorda and Joe Montana. And here's a company that's bullying its way onto your console that makes sports games. You know, that kind of. Casts a shadow, you know. You don't want another company to steal your thunder.
Right.
So I think that had a lot to do with it. But in the end, you know, Sega really at that time couldn't be turning third-party companies away.
Right.
They had to. I mean, if you look at the list of companies that made games for the console, I remember the first poster that had just like were all Sega games, and then another poster that came with the games had like companies, you know, like all these companies are making games. You had like. You had a Kaneko, and you had a Razorsoft, and you had all these companies. And my friends were like, "Who the hell are these people?
Right.
You know, where's Capcom? Mm-hmm. Where's Konami? Where's Acclaim?" It's like, well, okay, but we've got, you know, we've got a Sage's Creation.
We've got renovations.
Okay, you know, but then we were like, okay, well, at least there's somebody, you know, there. And of course, nobody knew that Renovations was like the American arm of Telenet Japan, which was this major developer there, you know, and Sage's Creation, a lot of their releases were basically like Crackdown they took Sega games that Sega they weren't on Sega's schedule and they just licensed and released them under their own name, you know, but you didn't know any of these things. Nobody knew anything about licensing when they're in high school, you know.
Right.
Nobody's like, oh, Crackdown, that's a Sega title. They must have licensed it, you know. We're just, like, okay, Sage's Creation is releasing Insector X, all right, you know. So we didn't have any other option. And then, like, okay, Electronic Arts, Sega's not going – and a company that was growing the way Electronic Arts was, they weren't going – they weren't in a position to say no.
Right. Yeah, I think that if – and Electronic Arts had pretty much said, like, if you don't license us, we're going to share this information with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would have destroyed the platform if they had said no to EA, because it would have turned into one of those, you know, wastelands of free-for-all crap software like the Atari 2600. And that sank the 2600. It was a huge problem for Nintendo with the Famicom in Japan because they didn't have the licensing system there for a long time. I think they were smart to say, like, it's better to kind of suck up our pride and eat a little bit of shit as opposed to eating a lot of shit and just, you know, keeping that 2% of the market share.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, they started the Sega Seal of Quality, like Nintendo and Seal of Quality. And it took as a kid, it took you a long time to realize that Seal of Quality did not necessarily mean gameplay.
Well, I think if you had played a lot of Seal of Quality NES games from some of the sketchier third parties, you were like, quality. Yeah, okay, sure, okay. Yeah.
And it was only afterward that you realized basically Seal of Quality was they have a license from us. You know, we're letting them make games. But they had no choice, really. So it did work out in the end, at least, on the Genesis.
And Tengen was actually a licensed Genesis publisher, right? Whereas they were not licensed. Well, initially they were, but very quickly went and became sort of the key, like the lead unlicensed publisher on NES.
Yeah, well, Sega would do a lot of those things kind of like to piss Nintendo off. Just like Sega took Galoob, Nintendo took Galoob to court And Sega gave them a seal of quality and said, go ahead, release the game Genie. You know, they kind of did those things to show, like, it was all part of the attitude and the whole we're the cool company thing they had going at the time.
Get the game Genie. Now you can actually get to level 2 of Comics Zone. Congratulations, kids.
If you're a DC fan, you'll definitely want to check out the latest live-action series, Titans, available now on DC Universe. This series premiered on October 12th, and new episodes are available to stream every Friday. Titans is the first original series to launch on DC Universe, and it follows a group of young, soon-to-be superheroes. Like Robin, Batman's former sidekick, now trying to break free of his Robin alter ego. Raven, a guarded teenager who's starting to experience the emergence of supernatural power she just doesn't understand. Starfire, a mysterious alien warrior with exceptional powers, but her memory loss is preventing her from knowing her own identity and her mission on Earth. This group gets caught up in conspiracy to bring about hell on Earth, and they become a surrogate family and team of heroes. This is a gritty take on the Teen Titans franchise from executive producers Akiva Goldsman, Jeff Johns, Greg Berlanti, Greg Walker, Sarah Schechter, and John Fawcett. Titans explores one of the most popular comic book teams ever, and it's only available on DC Universe on all your favorite devices. DC Universe is only $7.99 a month or 20% off for a yearly membership. Join the ultimate DC membership at DCUniverse.com and check out Titans.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
Putting the master code, 20 lines of code, we only get to level 2. That game was even with, because there are some games that even with, you know, invincibility or whatever, there was still just, because they would give you like invincibility, but if you fall down a pit, invincibility doesn't work. And so then there's a level that's like just all pits. Mm. So like your code is useless.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's Sega did not scrimp on the challenge, the difficulty. That was kind of their thing. I mean, they were very much an arcade developer, and I feel like they brought that attitude home. That's something we talked about in the previous segment of this episode, or this conversation, is that, you know, Sega started in the arcades, and arcades are about like, keep pumping in those quarters, kids, and you're not pumping in quarters at home. But they never quite, for a lot of their games, never quite step back from that mindset of like, our gamers want to be challenged. We must make it difficult for them. And maybe that's true. I don't know.
Yeah, they had to, for example, like Shinobi. In some cases, though, they actually had to – they even like realized like, holy shit, you know, we kind of – we set the bar a little bit too higher in difficulty. So you have like Shinobi. And anyone who's played the arcade game Shinobi knows that the last level is very brutal, and the last boss – very brutal, you know, no continues. And then the Master System version, which was done by the team that ended up doing Revenge of Shinobi, they were like, we should put a life bar, you know, one hit kills. And so they made some tweaks to it, and a lot of those elements ended up being incorporated in Revenge of Shinobi. But it's like, that's one example where they realized, yeah, that we made it just a little, we went a little bit too far with the difficulty there. But, I mean, my first example that, you know, with Revenge of Shinobi, you know, and Golden Axe had difficulty levels, and you could up the lives and make your life bar 5 instead of 3. And so they kind of make adjustments there. But then I saw like Phantasy Star 2 that came with a 110-page hint book. I was like, the game actually brings a hint book? You know, that's not screwing around. And
yeah, I mean, that was kind of a standard thing with console RPGs back in the early days. Dragon Warrior and Final Fantasy and a few other games came. I mean, Earthbound came with like the entire strategy guide that they would normally sell for $15. So I think there was a kind of an assumption like American kids need some help with these games that have words in them.
Yeah, but even like with Phantasy Star 2, even with the hint book, you get to like to the dams. On Palma, you get even with the hint book, that's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just it was a lot of it is no, it's a waltz. You know, step and fight, step and fight, step and fight. And so then you have like just these transporters all over the place. So when they saw that they actually packaged it with the hint book, you know, and then like EA with their RPGs, I was talking to one of the vendors, like if you took the King's Bounty manual and put it on one side and the Might and Magic manual on the other and put the Starflight manual on top, you have a hurricane proof shelter because those manuals are like 300 pages each.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was just beyond intimidating that the instruction manual was an encyclopedia practically.
Yeah. So, I'm kind of curious to get your take on two of the big factors of the Nintendo Sega console war. I'm always looking at things from sort of like the side of someone who owned a Nintendo system. But as a Sega kid, what was your perception of Street Fighter II and of Donkey Kong Country? Like, were those even factors for you? Did you care, or did you look at those and say, "Ah, damn you, Nintendo! You took the good stuff."
Well, it kind of went back and forth because, like, we love Final Fight, and then we got Streets of Rage,
right?
You know,
plus you got the good Final Fight on Sega CD.
Yeah, yeah. And so then, like, you get Thunder Force 3, we got it first, you know, and things like that. So there's a lot of that. Every release was like new ammunition for that argument. But like Street Fighter 2, when that came out, I remember my friend bought it. We started playing at like 10 o'clock and I left his house at like 11 a.m. the next day. You know, it was insane. They just all night, the two of us just, cause you had the code where you could actually use the same character, you know, and we just spent all night playing that game. And I remember leaving thinking like, damn it, you know, that's. And then the ad, I think the initial ad said like, basically it's like.
Yeah, you won't see it on Genesis.
Yeah, you won't see it on Genesis. And then when Special Champion Edition was announced, that was like, you know, that was it. You know, with that, you were like, that puts it on the same level. Nobody, because people used to say, well, you know, you've got Konami and Capcom making their games, but they're like, they got their B teams, you know, and all the companies are just like give their leftovers to Genesis. And then
Castlevania Bloodlines is not a B team game.
No, it is not. No, I said, well, Konami's first game on the Genesis was Rocket Knight Adventure.
Mm-hmm. That is not a B-team game.
That is it. That's just triple A quality.
Yeah, that was by directed by Nakazato, who did Contra games.
That's
great.
Just triple A across the board. And yeah, I agree with you about Bloodlines and Contra's great. But you had those games, but then Street Fighter was like the holy grail right there. And then like, oh, we're not getting Street Fighter, we're getting Special Champion Edition. You know, so that one was really big. The other one you mentioned was
Donkey Kong Country, which you guys did not get.
No, I feel like people say like
you got Vector Man.
I don't know when people say that Vector Man was like Sega's answer. There was a big gap in release between the two. In all the conversations I've had with the people who worked on Vector Man, I never once got the impression they never once saw like, yeah, we were directly competing with a Donkey Kong Country. Yeah, there were, you know, the graphics, you know, that was, but but that seemed to be more of like, to me, that seems to be more like just the way that was like the first signs of the industry moving away from traditional sprite based artwork and moving towards trying to make things more 3D. Because then you got, you know, when you got to the Saturn, it was like the PlayStation, it was like everything had to be 3D. So I think it was just like the first signs of them moving in that direction. But the one thing that I thought about the graphics in Donkey Kong Country at the time were you know, they were awesome. They were just phenomenal for the time. But the fact that I was like, man, you know, like Nintendo took Donkey Kong and put him in this really kick-ass platformer. And so like that was like when I first started to think about like, wow, you could take a character that you wouldn't think Donkey Kong in a platformer. And they brought back one of their classic characters and they put them in this new type of game. And they just did a really, really excellent job with it, you know. And so that I didn't think that Sega had to come up with its the Sega didn't get Donkey Kong Country, a game like Donkey Kong Country. But it made me think, like, you know, like, it made me want them to bring, like, other classic franchises back. I was like, man, they could take Zillion, you know, or how come we didn't get Fantasy Zone in America, things like that. Like, because they just showed, like, Nintendo was showing that you could take one of a classic character and put him in his own title and just build this world around him. Mm-hmm. And it's become a franchise that endures to this day, you know, and that was the kind of thing that I wanted Sega to do more. And to this day, I still, you know, asking, why don't we have, you know, a new Alex Kidd? Why don't we have, you know, I want another Shinobi, 2D Shinobi. So, but yeah, I'm always asking for another 2D Shinobi. Even when they just release one, I'm always asking for another one. Because mm-hmm. you can't have another Shinobi.
So to kind of wrap up, I need to check out of the hotel room. What do you think is the Sega Genesis's legacy, from your perspective?
I think when people say console wars, I really think that there's a bigger picture between like the 16-bit generation. To me, the Genesis, the role the Genesis has in arcade history, in gaming history, is that it actually showed that. The first thing it did was it didn't may not have over you know in general terms won the 16-bit war, and there are many reasons between factors for that, them pulling out before Nintendo did and things like that, but it did break the monopoly that Nintendo had, and you wouldn't have had a Sony PlayStation and a Microsoft Xbox if Sega hadn't broken that iron grip that Nintendo had on the home console market. So even though it lost the Nintendo won that generation, in a sense, it kind of lost the war because it lost the dominance that it had. And, you know, it's a $40 billion company. It's still a premier hardware maker. You know, mm-hmm. poor baby. It suffered so much.
Right. So, you know, there were a lot of other competitors at the time, Atari, NEC, and so forth, yeah. SNK. What was it about Sega that made them the ones that were able to break Nintendo's hegemony?
I think it was a combination of factors, the risk taking and the constantly in your face, you know, nipping at your ankles attitude that the Americans had, and just the absolute stellar stable of developers, the AM studios, and just Sega had that. To me, that's why the book that I did on Sega's arcade history. I ended it at 2003 with the Sega Sammy merger, because that's when the Sega that I knew and grew up with, you know, kind of disappeared. That's because by then all those developers, Yuji Naka, Suzuki, Nakayama, all those guys had left. Sugano had all left. So, but all those guys were around in the 80s and the 90s, and it's just the talent that Sega had was just, and the thing is that these guys would make an arcade game and then they would turn around and make a console game, and they were both just like, they could do it all, you know, and it's just, they were up to the task on all fronts, and just that constant output of quality that Sega was able to do, in terms of software. Cause I've always seen Sega as a software company that just happened to make its own hardware. You know, but Sega's really a hardware company. They'd been making from slot machines in the 60s and 50s and 60s all the way to arcade games. That's basically what they were. But the thing was, is I personally view the hardware as just like the vehicle for the software. That if they didn't put it on their own hardware, they would have put it on somebody else's, you know, but the what drove the company was that creative design. And in the 80s, that was just on fire, 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. And Atari and 3DO just didn't have that. I mean, they had dedicated people. They had talented people, but they just didn't have that top tier,
right?
Cadre of developers. I mean, just multiple teams of them is just insane.
Well, and I don't think they had the right leadership either. I don't think their leaders were as focused as Sega's. And all right, well, I'm going to wrap up here. But thank you for giving us a more inside informed perspective on Sega Genesis for its 30th anniversary. Tell us a little bit about you. Where can people find you online? Pimp yourself, you know. Where can we find you on Twitter? What's this book you published? Go on and tell us all about this.
Okay, well, you can always find me on Sega16.com, www.sega-16.com. It's the website I've been running since 2004. We do comprehensive reviews, features, and interviews. This week, we'll be doing, I'll be putting up a retrospective on Sega's UFO Catcher series, the history of that line, which is a very important and vital part of Sega's arcade business. And we do interviews and features there. I've written two books on Sega's history, Playing at the Next Level, which is a history of Sega of America, all the way from its founding in 86, all the way through the end of Dreamcast development. Covers 40 games in detail. And the other book I did was Sega Arcade Revolution, which is the complete arcade history of Sega from its founding in the 1960s to the Sega Sammy merge in 2003. And that one covers 62 games in detail. And the Playing at the Next Level, I interviewed 100 people, multiple documents. This one, Sega Arcade Revolution, I interviewed 2 dozen people, but there are dozens of documents translated from Japanese, many of which were never translated into English before. And a lot of the interviews are exclusive, like the information on Shinobi came straight from Yutaka Sugano himself, thanks to John Serpaniak for that. And Jay Gearston, the guy who created Columns, gave me the complete rundown on that. And so there's a lot of good Sega history there. And those are great reference books. So I got in-text citations, full bibliographies and indexes.
Where can people find those?
Those can be found online on Amazon, barnesandnobles.com, straight from McFarland and Company, the publisher. And if you were here at the convention, I was selling some copies myself that you would have gotten cheaper and signed. So, but hopefully I'll be at more convention in the future, and I always bring copies to sell there. But you can get them off Amazon. Both copies are available there.
All right. Thanks, Ken. And
thank
of course, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on the internet at Retronauts.com, on Twitter as GameSpite, and Retronauts you'll find at Retronauts.com, on iTunes, on Podcatchers, at the Podcast One Network, and so on and so forth. So again, thanks, Ken, for coming on and fleshing out our Sega anniversary coverage.
Thank you very much.
Genesis anniversary coverage. And have a safe trip back home. And I'm sure I'll bump into you again at a future convention.
Hopefully so.
All right. Thanks.
Take care.
Caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.